From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Susan Davis. It's Here and Now. The president is wrapping up his trip to the G7 summit in France. He and French President Emmanuel Macron held a closing press conference with this message. Let's take a listen.
If there was any word for this particular meeting of seven very important countries, it was unity. I think most important of all, we got along great.
But his words come after another chaotic weekend of mixed messages from the White House, during which he called the Chinese president an enemy and called on U.S. companies to stop doing business in China. NPR White House reporter Aisha Rascoe joins us now. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
So let's start with China and trade. The president at one point seemed to express regret for his tariffs on China. Then the White House walked it back, said he didn't mean it. He only regretted that he didn't raise them higher. What did the president say for himself today about his China strategy?
Well, he said that it is his strategy to kind of go back and forth and at one point say that she is an enemy and say that China is basically that he didn't want to get a deal with China. And then today he's saying they want it, that China wants a deal and that now he thinks that a deal can really happen if it's in the U.S. interest. But he said that this is his strategy. This is what has worked for him. Now, with China so far, we haven't seen the evidence of that this is really working, and we certainly haven't seen a final deal. But he claims that this is what has helped him in the business world, and so he's just going to keep it up.
It's just a tactic.
Yes.
Yeah. The president doesn't have a great track record of G7 summits. If you recall, last year's summit in Canada, he left early. He left angry. In the big picture, how did this trip play out for President Trump?
There wasn't a big blow up with him and other leaders this time around. He said that there was, as was said earlier, that there was unity there. I should say that President Trump typically will say that when he's on the foreign stage, no matter what actually happened before.
Behind the scenes.
Yeah, he basically says that everyone got along great. But what you could see, the proof that there is has been a lot of division is the fact that they only have this one-page agreement that all seven parties could sign on to, when usually you have a much more extensive communique, is proof that this wasn't an easy task for these countries to really come together and put forward a united front.
Well, the president also made a case that no one else seemed to be making was to allow Russia back into the G7. Russia was kicked out of what was then the G8 in 2014. Why did he make that argument, and how was it received?
He keeps saying that all of these topics that are talked about at these international gatherings or at the G7, many of them involve Russia or Russia is involved in. So why shouldn't we have them inside the tent and be talking to them? And he says that other people agree with him. But so far, publicly, he's alone standing here saying that they should be invited. And other countries have publicly said that they don't think that Russia should be back in the G7 because it annexed Crimea and that issue hasn't really been addressed.
The world leaders also gathered to address an issue captivating the globe, the raging wildfires in the Amazon. They agreed to provide $20 million to try and combat those fires. But President Trump didn't attend the meeting on climate. Why not? And what message is the administration sending with that?
He didn't attend, the White House was trying to say that maybe there were scheduling issues there. All the other world leaders were able to get their schedules together to attend. But President Trump was asked about climate change, and he basically said that the U.S. is invested in the oil and gas industry, and that's where they want to put their emphasis, and that they don't want to worry about that renewable energy. And he basically said that that was more of a dream and that he's focused on the reality of oil and gas. And so what you have is a president who is basically dismissing concerns about climate change.
That's NPR White House reporter Aisha Rascoe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, in addition to the money raised at the G7 to battle the Amazon fires, Brazil's president, Bolsonaro, has authorized military operations, but that hasn't stopped international outrage over Brazil's slow response. Now, the fires were largely purposely set by farmers to clear land, but they've been fanned by the hot climate. French President Macron has blamed Bolsonaro, accusing him of lying about his commitments to fighting climate change. The Brazilian president hit back with a Facebook post insulting Macron's wife. Macron then threatened to block a European trade deal with Brazil and other South American countries over the fires. CNN senior international correspondent Nick Peyton Walsh has seen the devastation firsthand. He's been flying through the smoke in a Cessna.
Understand.
More startling is how much of this immense jungle people have managed to destroy in so short a time.
Unbelievable.
They had help. Fires they lit, and that happen naturally in the dry heat, but usually peak later in the year.
This is not just a forest burning. This is almost a cemetery, because all you can see is dead.
Nick Payton-Walsh is back. He joins us from the city of Portoveiro in the Brazilian Amazon. Nick, further describe that smoke.
It's difficult to actually, because, I mean, it's almost like a house fire to some degree. You kind of feel that intensity when you fly through it. And there are moments when the visibility was so bad, we had to get the plane higher up, 1,500 feet. And even that didn't get you out of it. And so there's moments when you're not quite sure which direction you fly and whether or not you'll ever get to clear sky again. Yeah. It's amazing to look down because the premise of this deforestation is life. They're meant to be growing things. They're meant to be trying to put cattle on the land to farm things. But the process in which they go about it just destroys anything approaching life there at all. So yeah, I mean, I saw one bird in the air the entire time we were flying in what's supposed to be a natural paradise. There's a lot of bewildered looking cattle down there, you know, feeding cattle, feeding them soy grown on the land or letting them graze on the land to produce beef is a major part of why this deforestation is happening. So the devastation is absolutely breathtaking, frankly. I didn't see a single person down there. Hard to imagine how people could live in that kind of smoke. We didn't see any of the 43,000 Brazilian soldiers that are supposed to be on their way to try and combat this. You can't underestimate the insurmountability of this task. It's massive ahead of them. And I frankly, you know, wish them luck in trying to get a handle on it.
Well, that's the next question. Is it too late? You know, we talk about the Amazon being the planet's lungs, and obviously those lungs are gasping. Is it too late to reverse that?
No, it's not too late. I mean, obviously, you know, no doomsayers should stand here and say we're already past the point of no return. And what we're seeing now is an abnormally bad year of fires. Fires do occur, and sometimes they're man-made, sometimes they're part of the dry season. There's a dispute about how much which of which is occurring this year, but it's extremely serious. It can't be denied. You fly over large parts of the Amazon which are not on fire. So, you know, the entire forest is not aflame, and it isn't imminently about to be in that direction. But the amount of damage being done is unprecedented. If you think about 1.5 football fields being cleared every minute, so probably about 4 or 5 will be done during the period of you and me talking. That is an unprecedented rate, destroying something which is a resource the entire planet needs just to be able to breathe. The question really we're worrying about, many scientists looking at this, is when the tipping point comes, because we don't know an awful lot about how these ecosystems work, but increasingly it seems clear that the more deforestation occurs, the less moisture is held within the forest beneath the canopy. And the drier it is, the more susceptible it is potentially for fire. And when the forest goes, then you have savanna, and that's very hard to get back into being forest again. And that damages the ecosystem of all of Brazil. It damages the ecosystem of the continent. It might actually damage the ability for the south of the country to get rainfall, because everything is interlinked in terms of how moisture functions in this environment. That's Brazil's immediate trouble. The major problem you and I face is if we don't get the Amazon, frankly, back to where it was, we potentially lose 20% of the oxygen we breathe, let alone adding millions of gigatons of carbon to that in the atmosphere, which is already causing global warming.
Yeah. Well, and we know that what the trees in the Amazon do, as all trees do, is pull in that carbon dioxide, take it out of the atmosphere, and also release oxygen. Look, just can you briefly touch on the politics here? We know that Brazil's president campaigned on developing the Amazon. He rolled back environmental regulations in Brazil. But now his back is against the wall. It feels as if a lot of ego is involved here. Will he do the right thing?
It's difficult to know, really, because there are some who say this is exactly where President Jair Bolsonaro wanted to be. The disruptor, the kind of Trump-esque figure, doing what his base wants to see done, wishing away all the various different types of science and real think that out there in the world are telling him his policies are a bad idea. He has clearly had to acknowledge internationally that there's a lot of criticism and that this fire needs to be fought, and he sent the army in. It's unclear if they can get a handle on it. But at the same time, too, you know, if you have a president who's finding himself on social media, it seems, laughing at derogatory memes put out about the French president's wife, one of his key critics, that doesn't suggest someone taking this particularly seriously. It's becoming an interpersonal spat. Now, his point is that this is Brazil's resource, and there's no colonial powers that should be telling Brazil what to do. It's slightly in contradiction, though, with Brazil's history, because they've had pretty tough environmental laws for quite some time, because they know how important the Amazon is for them, let alone just the rest of the planet. But I think possibly in the short term, you might believe there's some kind of political points to be scored domestically for this, being no doubt the reason why this deforestation is happening at this kind of level is because he's been saying it's a good idea for a long time. So had that not occurred, I don't think we'd be seeing fires on this level.
CNN senior international correspondent Nick Payton Walsh in Porto Velho, Brazil. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And of course, this is a story we will be following probably for some time. Just got back from a trip down the Green River. Among the memories, a cougar dashing across a dirt road, an antelope bounding through a field in Wyoming. I tried to capture it all in photos, but a beaver in Colorado looks like a blob of black and rushing water. A bald eagle in Utah is a dot in the sky. I was hoping to get some tips from our next guest, who says when it comes to wildlife, first and foremost, do no harm. Melissa Grew is a much-admired wildlife photographer. Her article for National Geographic is titled How to Photograph Wildlife Ethically. She's at the Cornell Studios in Ithaca, New York. Melissa Grew, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
What does that mean, ethical wildlife photography? I mean, I can guess it means, you know, try not to infringe on habitat or frighten an animal, but what more does it mean to you?
The more that I've learned about wildlife photography, the more I've come to understand that it's not really about rules of right or wrong. It's more about nuances and really bringing decisions to bear upon each time that we're out there, because each animal is so different. So it's really about sort of building into our field craft, you know, how can we be out there and be really sensitive and really attuned to the bird or other animal in front of us.
And so you start with do no harm, and yes, don't interrupt what the animals would normally be doing. But for instance, take special care at breeding season. How do you know it's breeding season?
There's so much information out there at our fingertips on the internet. And if we can just arm ourselves with some basic information about that species, you know, what are the signs of stress and what are the cycles in their lives? And it's vitally important to understand what the threats are to a particular animal, or whether it's endangered or it's threatened.
Yeah. So you're saying it's your job as the photographer to do the research.
Absolutely.
As you say, never alter vegetation around nests or dens.
Absolutely. I do know that some people, professionals to amateurs, may alter habitat around a nest or a den because they're searching for a more sort of aesthetically pleasing image. But what they're not taking into account, or perhaps ignoring, is that the animal or the bird chose that particular spot because it provides such perfect camouflage and because it shields the young from the elements, from the harsh sun, from the wind, from the cold.
Well, you also say keep it wild, and that includes no feeding wildlife to get a picture. And I didn't know this, that if you feed an animal, as you note, Yellowstone National Park's website states a fed animal
is a dead animal, absolutely.
The Park Service will destroy them.
Absolutely. Foxes that have become habituated, for instance, to people feeding them from cars. For one thing, they may often get hit by cars because they run towards cars, but also their emboldened behavior can really be perceived as a threat to people and can be threatening to people just walking around because they come to associate all humans with that handout. And so there's been many cases where foxes have had to be put down by the staff at Yellowstone. There was an incident last year in Grand Teton where a black bear mama and her two cubs were being fed fruit from cars, and she had to be euthanized, and her two young are now living out their lives in captivity.
Terrible. Also, you know, it endangers the animal, it endangers people. Even though it's big business, you point out in Eastern and Northern Europe, people offer food near blinds for photographers who are inside the blinds so that the animals will come for the food. But then, in addition to all the dangers, and you just described one, I mean, animals then expect to go to people and get food. That's not real. Those animals that might come together to get food at a blind would never be together.
Yes, this is not natural history. This is not a depiction of reality. This is a very artificially created situation. And I think it does viewers a disservice It paints this sort of Disney-like view of the world at a time when people are increasingly disconnected from nature. And I really feel it's incumbent on us as photographers, whether we're amateurs or we're professionals, to accurately depict nature, to really try to connect people to the realities of nature. And that's the beauty of nature. It is wild. And I'm always trying to tell people, let's keep it wild.
Look, but this brings us to the conundrum that you, as a wildlife photographer and someone who loves wildlife, face every day, which is, should we take pictures at all? And you say, yeah, because you want to conserve, you want people to know about conserving these creatures. So this is a conundrum for you as well, how to best do it to, in fact, save them, not endanger them.
It absolutely is, and conservation photography is a new, well, relatively new, but rapidly growing genre of photography wherein photographers, you know, it's not just about taking that picture, it's about doing something with that photo, even if it's just on social media, and anyone can be a conservation photographer. It's really about using your photos to go to work in service of that animal, and it's about educating other people how to better respect the wildlife that we're so lucky to have with us or that we're so lucky to travel to see. So how do we sort of really use our photos to advocate and to conserve? And it's about being accurate and truthful on social media. You know, the power of visual imagery is really stronger than it's ever been in history, and photos can quickly go viral. And I think as photographers, we have so much power. You know, and I feel we're at a time when wild animals are increasingly pressured and increasingly in fragmented areas. And we, as photographers, wildlife watchers, birders, we've got online databases and instant messaging and GPS and thermal imaging and drones and camera traps, all of these tools that give us so much power. And yet we've lost half of Earth's wildlife in the last 40 years, and one in four species is at risk of going extinct. And so it's really about, you know, how can we be out there and tell these crucial stories and yet leave as little footprint as we can and understand the distances that we have to be from certain animals. You know, you heard about this girl getting tossed perhaps in Yellowstone last month by a bison. They were within 5 to 10 feet. Of that bison just completely flouting the park's rules.
Well, another thing we heard a lot when we were out west last week, we're on the East Coast right now, but, you know, how many people were dying from taking selfies of themselves in national parks. It's just photography has become, it's got all sorts of ethical ramifications. But I just want to go through, Melissa Grew, some of the other things you point out. Drones are also can have terrible negative effects on animals. A study showed that black bears' heartbeats, you know, went up 123 beats per minute. Drones are not safe necessarily for animals. Photography game farms, where it's popular in Montana, Minnesota, you know, they have the captured animals there and they promise you these great shots. But again, maybe they're luring the animals with food. Maybe these are animals that shouldn't be in captivity. A lot of things to think about before you take a picture of an animal. But I just want to ask you, you mentioned that one of the things you'd like to see is transparency from professionals in particular. How did they get the shot? That should be included with the shot when it goes out on social media. Can you tell us, you know, we have, as we said, beautiful shots from you at hereandnow.org. For instance, there's a snowy owl and her chick right up close. You're in the nest with them. How did you get that shot?
That was in Utqiagvik in Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost point in the U.S., which is the last stronghold of snowy owls nesting. And I worked very closely with a biologist, and he had set up a blind quite a distance from the nest. And I was, of course, working with my 600 millimeter with a 2x teleconverter, which granted me 1,200 millimeters, and those photos are cropped. Every time I approached the blind, though, it would instantly flush the female off the nest. And that gave me great angst to see her disturbed and worried for her young. But, you know, it's really a balance. It's that decision that you have to make. Is this story really crucially important? Do you have an avenue in which you're going to tell a critically important story about a threatened animal or an endangered animal, and it's going to get a great audience and and you're going to be able to perhaps attract funding to the biologist and all of that. So that's what I mean about every time we go out, if it's a really sensitive situation, we have to make very careful decisions, work with biologists when we can, and really find a way to make those pictures go to work. But I will say the scariest moment I've ever had as a wildlife photographer was being dive bombed by the father of those young. Snowy owl males are incredibly fierce mm-hmm. in protecting their young. And he came at me and I had to duck and roll, and he would have taken my scalp off with his talons if he could have. I'm not scared of anything, but that was truly scary.
You still took the picture of the mother with the child.
Yes, I got into that blind, and after a few moments, the mother returned to the nest, and the chicks were fine, and I sat very still in that blind for hours in the freezing cold and documented their relationship. I documented the male bringing in lemmings, which are their primary food source there, the rodents of the tundra, and I was able to capture these really intimate moments. So in the end, I feel in the balance that really was worth it.
Melissa Grew, ethical wildlife photographer, conservationist, will also post her National Geographic article, How to Photograph Wildlife Ethically, at herenow.org. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much. If I could just end with one last word for all of us to keep in mind, that for us, it's just about a photo. But for that animal, every single moment is about survival.
Stocks opened slightly higher this morning after President Trump said that he'd gotten a call from China and officials want to come back to the negotiating table. Later, China's foreign ministry said it was unaware of any phone calls. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. She regularly helps us parse these kinds of tea leaves. Jill, just to recap here, on Friday, both sides escalated their tariffs in the trade war. The Dow fell 600 points. And now we have this claim of a phone call no one seems to know anything about. Your thoughts?
More of the same, perhaps. I think that what has essentially occurred is that while the president was at the G7, there was a lot of phone calls back and forth. There was a lot of phone calls from business leaders. Certainly the reaction to the past 5 or 6 weeks has been pretty negative from businesses in the United States. So I think that what the president was attempting to do was kind of tamp down the emotions a little bit, even though he's the one who had ratcheted them up in some respects. That said, we don't really know who called who. Right now, the only thing we do know is that the two sides are scheduled to actually sit down and talk in September. Maybe that happens sooner, but that's where we are right now. There are talks that are scheduled. We hope that they occur as soon as possible.
So that was always happening. You mentioned American businesses and a lot of phone calls there. The president ordered American businesses to get out of China immediately. He is pointing to a law that many say doesn't apply here. What is the sense of what can happen on that front and how businesses are reacting?
Well, this is a law that's called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or by the easy to remember IEEPA. All right. So here's the deal. The president can declare an emergency, which then allows for broad authority to block activities of companies or economic sectors with a potential enemy. Now, when I spoke to lawyers over the weekend, they said to me they think that if President Trump and the administration were to somehow label China as an enemy because of its trade policies, that the president could, in fact, invoke these powers. That said, there would be such a pushback from the business community. This would be devastating to where we are in the process of trade negotiations.
Well, of course, this is all the talk of the G7. And I want to ask you what you make of an exchange between President Trump and Boris Johnson as they were sitting around a table and reporters were asking questions. The president saying that, you know, everybody at the G7 supported his trade war, his tariffs. Boris Johnson almost immediately saying, well, we'd actually like to see peace. We actually, if I can sheep-like, I think he said, if I can sheep-like say, we really don't agree with you. What's your sense there?
My sense is that the retort to that would be, and we really don't like the youth that we're considering a hard Brexit. You know, look, every country has its own domestic political opinions that they have to kind of stoke slash adhere to, right? And also, I think that obviously the global economy is already slowing down. So these trade conflicts are adding more headwinds to a process that had already begun. Now, that said, every nation would like to see a path that is a more traditional, where there is diplomacy and meetings and behind-the-scenes negotiations, not something in public, but that's not what they have with President Trump.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst, host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
In the coming decades, the senior population is set to double. The number of people over the age of 85 will nearly triple. The aging population is rising, but the number of elder care workers is shrinking, and it's raising questions about how we can empathetically care for our elders as a society and in our families. To talk more about this, we're joined now by Dr. Elizabeth Eggstrom. She's chief of geriatrics at Oregon Health and Science University and the author of the book, The Gift of Caring. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
There is going to be a demand for millions of healthcare workers in the coming decades, not to mention geriatricians, geriatric nurses. How prepared is the country for that?
We're absolutely unprepared. You know, in the past, I think our country and others have relied primarily on family members to do care for elders, and that is just shrinking and shrinking, and probably worse here than other places in the world, but happening everywhere. And what's happening is that there are so many elders that we just aren't having enough young people who can do that role. When I travel around the world, I notice that other places still have a family infrastructure that allows for some elder care, but here in the U.S., it's very fragmented and almost gone. So instead, we rely on paid caregivers, and there just aren't enough of them. And one of the things is that it requires a fair bit of training, and yet the pay is extremely low. People walk into those jobs and just realize that they're incredibly hard, and it's really hard to retain people in that field.
The Washington Post recently did a spotlight on one state, the state of Maine, which has the oldest population in the country. A fifth of the population is older than the age of 65. But we know this is going to be happening in more and more states. Is it possible that the federal programs, I'm thinking of things like Medicare, Medicaid, can help fill these gaps?
Yeah, well, Medicare right now does not pay for any of these services. Medicare is kind of strictly hospitals, physician practices. They will pay for in-home skilled nursing services if somebody needs that after a hospitalization or something. But any of the long-term support and services that older adults need is not covered by Medicare at all. That could certainly change. It would be wonderful if it did. Now, Medicaid does pick up a fair bit of this work, but unfortunately, you have to be pretty poor to qualify for Medicaid. So a lot of elders just don't qualify for it. And I think, you know, expanding the Medicaid program could be helpful as well. But somehow we need to kind of pick up that gap for people who are above the cutoff for Medicaid. There needs to be some ability to have financial support for caregiving, which is very expensive.
I wonder if you see any overlap with the debate we're having over immigration right now, because immigrants disproportionately make up a lot of the workforce serving the elderly. And if we are also reducing our immigration population, is that fueling this worker crisis?
Absolutely. I think that as the immigration rates go down, as people are more kind of afraid to be in the workforce here, if they are in our country undocumented, it will become harder and harder to find caregivers for older adults. And we don't have an answer to that question right now. There's no other workforce that's taking it over. You know, young Americans are not stepping into roles to kind of fill in some of those gaps. So it's making the crisis even more acute at this point in time.
Why do you think younger Americans don't want those jobs?
Oh, we have a culture of youth here. There's just so little respect for older adults. There's so little understanding of how valuable and meaningful relationships can be with older adults. We don't foster intergenerational relationships very strongly right now. All of those things have kind of happened gradually, but are really coming to a peak right now, so that young people don't really have much access to older adults. And that's something that we really need to change.
You referenced other countries. I mean, obviously, this is a global problem. Other countries are also confronting aging populations. Do you see any good models in other countries for elder care service? And if so, what do they look like?
I think some of the countries that have put in place social services for this are places like Sweden, where if you're older, you have a disability, you need care, they have in-home workers that can go see you as often as every 2 hours. They're not there 24/7, but they can stop by every 2 hours. And that is all paid for under the state or the country health insurance, so that you do not have any out-of-pocket expenses and can get a visitor that frequently. I don't know that anyone has the perfect answer yet. I think we have need for lots more research into what really works and then how to pay for it, because that's one of the biggest glitches right now.
Well, how to pay for it seems like one of the bigger questions, which is if the government can come up with a solution, it does seem that the burden still falls to families, right, to care for their elders.
Correct.
Care perspective, does that mean that elders are getting substandard care and that many family workers are just, they're not healthcare professionals?
Yeah. It's hard to define substandard care. I mean, I think people are trying their hardest most of the time. You know, one of the things that we highlighted in our book, The Gift of Caring, that you referenced early, was that even my co-author, Marcy Houl, who is very savvy, you know, a really smart woman, she felt in so many times that she just, you know, didn't know the right answer. And she's highly educated and just in these conundrums where she didn't know what to do. And, you know, that was after all, she had basically sacrificed her own career during that period of her life. She was trying to raise kids. And I think a lot of us are in that boat where we're trying to do elder care without the skills we need. It's really not even fair to have those expectations of our family members. And yet we do.
Families face so many healthcare problems, but one very common one is the question of dementia. Can you talk a little bit about how significant dementia affects the aging population and what you think people really need to understand about it?
Well, first of all, people need to understand that it's not a normal part of aging. I think a lot of people think that cognitive impairment is just comes with growing older.
Yeah.
And yet it's not. There are a few things that are normal with aging, which we probably all recognize on a daily basis if we're over age 50 or so. And that is that we have more trouble with word finding. We might forget names. They might come back to us later and we're like, oh, darn it. It's also normal to have slowed speed of processing. Now, we probably all realize that we're not as good at double tasking as we thought we were, but that is a normal part of aging. But it's not normal to have true memory gaps. It's not normal to start to, you know, have trouble with finances so that you can't do them at all. There are a lot of things about dementia that are not normal, and that's what we really need to identify. Now, it does occur differently in age groups. So 65 to 75, probably only 2 to 4% of people have it. 75 to 85, it's probably more like 16%. Over 85, some figures quoted as high as about 40% of people will have true dementia. Another thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that there are things you can do to prevent it.
Like what?
You know, if you are walking regularly and doing Tai Chi regularly, which has some nice evidence for reducing risk of dementia, if you're eating the Mediterranean diet, if you're staying engaged both cognitively and socially, all of those things reduce the risk of developing dementia. Honestly, some of the research studies that show the best risk reduction for dementia start at age like 35 to 55.
Wow.
But you can start doing those things at any age, even if you're already 82 and starting to have some memory decline. You can still change habits and have your cognition be protected.
What is your best advice for caregivers who are dealing with a parent or loved one who is dealing with the effects of dementia in later ages?
Yeah, so a couple things that I talk about a lot are how do you be in the moment with that person? You know, a lot of times somebody with dementia will be like, oh, I'm waiting for mom to come home. And the lovely daughter caregiver says, Mom, your mom's been dead for 20 years. And for that person with dementia, that is new information every single time they hear it. So anything about reality orientation, you know, oh, it's time to get up and go to breakfast and it's 2 in the morning. Don't say, no, it's not time to get up and go to breakfast. Just say, hey, how about we take a little walk and then we're going to try to head back to bed. Using distraction, using ways to kind of change the scene so that incorrect perception doesn't raise problems, doesn't raise frustrations in the relationship is one thing that I say. The other thing that I say for caregivers is remember that your attitude shapes their perceptions. And if you can keep your attitude light and fresh and friendly and loving at all times, you're going to be able to connect with your loved one who has dementia, no matter how late stage their dementia is. You know, being able to maintain that positive attitude no matter what the situation, very, very challenging, but helps make sure that that person with dementia feels loved, feels cared for, feels needed, feels important. And then the third big tip I give people is you've got to take care of yourself.
Yeah, who cares for the caregivers?
Yeah, prevent yourself from getting dementia. But really, in reality, if you're not sleeping enough, if you're not maintaining your own social life, you're going to have a decline. And so many times, you know, the caregiver dies before the person with dementia, because dementia can linger for many years, and that caregiver might just really, you know, run out of steam before the person with dementia does.
Well, Dr. Ekstrom, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk with you.
That's Elizabeth Ekstrom, Chief of Geriatrics at Oregon Health and Science University.
When a new opera called Blue finished its run at the Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York last week, it marked a promising moment for advocates of racial diversity in the predominantly white world of American opera. In quick succession this summer, three high-profile companies debuted operas written by African Americans, telling stories from the Black American experience. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jeremy Goodwin reports, Black opera artists say there's an important shift underway, not only who gets to tell the stories on the lyric stage, but what those stories are about.
When George Shirley started out as a young Black opera singer in the late 1950s, there weren't a lot of jobs in the field for people who looked like him.
There had been occasional performances by Black instrumentalists and singers with symphony orchestras, but they were few and far between.
Black artists wrote and performed opera, but had to fight for opportunities. In 1962, Shirley became the first African-American baritone to sing a lead role at New York's Metropolitan Opera. There was progress, but not enough.
Life is sort of like the waves of the ocean. We have crests and we have troughs. And after the crest of activity in the 60s, it was very hopeful, then we dropped into a trough. But I think we may be approaching another crest.
Shirley sees evidence for that new wave of Black voices in a trio of American operas that made world premieres this summer. Long Branch Opera outside Los Angeles staged the Central Park Five. It's about the Black and Latino teenagers falsely imprisoned for a 1989 assault on a white jogger. Opera Theater of St. Louis presented Fire Shut Up in My Bones, based on the memoir by New York Times columnist Charles Blow, a Black man. That's soprano Karen Slack singing as Blow's mom, Billy. And then came Blue at Glimmerglass Festival in upstate New York. It's about a Black family whose teenage son is killed by police. Each opera was written by Black composers and librettists, staged with predominantly Black creative teams. Tazewell Thompson wrote the libretto for Blue. Early in his career, he got a boost from a hit production he directed of Porgy and Bess, a show that's provided a foothold in professional opera for many Black artists. The 1935 piece about a poor Black community in South Carolina was written by three white men. Thompson says he loves the music George Gershwin wrote for it, but
I don't really know too much about the world of Porgy and Bess and Catfish Row, but the world of Blue, set in Harlem, that is something that I know a great deal about.
In Blue, a father played by Kenneth Kellogg tells his 16-year-old son to have a more clean-cut look so he won't be threatening to police.
Dress like somebody's damn gypsy and get a haircut, pull up your pants, remove the jewelry, take off the hoodie, take off the hoodie, the hoodie, the hoodie, the hoodie, the hoodie.
I think that is the responsibility now of opera houses and composers and librettists to tell the stories that are happening right now.
In Fire Shut Up in My Bones, Charles Blow is depicted as a precocious child and then young man in rural Louisiana. All of the characters are Black. That piece, and the Central Park Five, and Blue, do do more than just create more roles for black performers. They help broaden the idea of what opera can be about. Karen Slack, the soprano.
As a woman of color, as a black woman, specifically an opera singer, I don't sing about myself.
Now, she says, it's time for some new classics.
To me, the overwhelming thing is all these real blooded stories told by black people through black people. I think it's time. We're a little overdue. Tell all the stories. It's important.
By hearing more stories from the black experience, opera-goers get a fuller picture of the American experience. George Shirley, the path-breaking baritone at the Met, says American history is perfect fodder for opera.
I've longed to see this happen, and I hope that composers now will take this ball and run with it in a manner that exposes our history to those who don't know it, who should know it, who should be moved by it, who should learn from it so that we don't repeat the same mistakes.
There are signs the momentum will continue. In June 2020, Lyric Opera of Chicago will perform Blue in a season that also includes pieces by Mozart and Puccini. For Here and Now, I'm Jeremy Goodwin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young, and we want to thank NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis for being with us a couple days this week. Thank you.
You're welcome, and I'll be back tomorrow, Robin, so we have more time together.
Yes, you will.
I'm Susan Davis. This is Here and Now.
But we keep multiplying and climbing and advancing. Now they can't get rid of us fast enough. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.